and said, "We like our church. Maybe someday, though." Mikey turned to Sam. "Alice is moving back to the area, you know."
"Is she?"
Mikey nodded. "I'll be seeing a lot more of her." Sam said, "Lucky you," and wiggled his eyebrows. Then he laughed.
"Alice is great. I just don't know that I'd want her for a next-door neighbor."
He nodded down the hallway toward the front door.
"Speak of the devil."
Alice was kneeling to untie her work boots at the front door. She wore black pants and a loose-fitting dark green sweater over her broad shoulders. There was snow in her hair. "She looks upset," Mikey observed when he saw Alice's face, but Sam did not hear him because he was already walking Justine up the hall for introductions. Mikey went to the kitchen and ate a crostino with prosciutto and fennel slaw. He waited until Alice had said hello to Sam and Jimmy, been introduced to Justine and Odvin, then been greeted by Lynn and Issa before he approached her. He offered a hug, and Alice was stiff. She accepted the hug but did not reciprocate. Mikey said, "What's up?"
"I'll tell you later," Alice said.
Mikey leaned closer to her.
"Alice, are you okay?"
She offered a tight-lipped mm-hmm, and her black eyes darted across the room.
"I'll tell you after the ceremony."
She nodded in the direction of the kitchen.
"I don't imagine there's any booze at this party."
"There's Prosecco in the fridge," Mikey said. "You want a glass?"
"How about five?" Alice said.
"By the way, I lost 10 pounds, thanks for noticing."
She pulled a toothpick from her pocket and began to suck on it voraciously.
"I'm trying this new fad diet. Read about it online. It's called Eat Less Food."
"Oh," Mikey said, leaning in to examine the side of her face. "Oh, I'm afraid you're not going to like this."
"What?"
Alice said.
"You're not going to like this one bit."
Mikey gripped a 3/4 of an inch long black hair from just beneath Alice's jawbone and pulled it out. It curled in his fingertips. He held it up for her to examine.
"Good God," she said, and batted it out of his hands.
Mikey opened a bottle of Prosecco and filled a flute for each of them, and one for Lynn's aunt, who suddenly appeared at his side. Alice looked directly at the woman's cleavage and sang,
"All righty then."
Mikey asked Alice if she was staying in town that night. She rotated the toothpick over her lips and nodded.
"Budget Inn, Lynn recommended. You?"
Mikey nodded. "Same place. Sounds like everybody else is taking off tonight. Jimmy heading north, Sam back south, has to work a half day tomorrow. Lynn and Issa have a 5 a.m. flight out of Philly, honeymooning in Scotland."
Alice said, "I guess it's just you and me for the night then, pal. We can eat bugles and watch Law and Order and play doctor."
Lynn's aunt, who had been listening to the conversation, stared at Alice. From the main room, Mikey could hear Lynn's voice as she assembled the group. They made their way back to that room, and Alice and Mikey stood next to Jimmy, Odvin, Sam, and Justine. Lynn and Issa were up at the arbor, and people were gathering before them. Lynn was counting heads.
19, 20, 21, 22, she said. "That's everybody."
The crowd grew quiet as Lynn and Issa stepped beneath the arbor. They held hands. Lynn introduced Lee as their officiant. The petite, gray-haired woman did not hold notes or a microphone as she took center stage.
"Lynn's only request was that I keep it brief," Lee said.
"Love," Lee announced, "is not a mystery. It is not poetry. It is not pure. It is not sacred. Nothing humans do is." The room, already quiet, was now completely silent.
"Love," Lee continued, "is simply the time you spend loving. There are no other rules. That's it."
Alice was still sucking noisily on her toothpick. She rolled it to the side of her lips and whispered down the row to Sam and Justine, the only married couple among them.
"Is that true?"
Justine was nodding in agreement.
"I think so. Hon, don't you think?"
Sam said, "It helps if you like the same TV shows, too." Alice whispered,
Also, I imagine, you hope they don't end up having some weird fetish, toe-sucking or bread-crushing.
Mikey made a face at her.
The hell?
Jimmy giggled.
Alice's whisper grew louder. It's a real thing. Guys pay women in high heels to crush loaves of bread in front of them, I swear.
Mikey said, shh. Lee led Lynn and Issa through their vows. Then they exchanged their wedding bands, placing them not on each other's fingers, but on long chains over each other's necks. When Lee pronounced them husband and wife, a cheer rose up from the small group, and one of Issa's cousins, who was seated at the piano, began to play Thelonious Monk's Ruby, My Dear. Issa took Lynn by the waist and kissed her, and they slow danced while the others cheered and then joined the dance. Sam held Justine's head against his chest and kissed it. Alice took Mikey by the elbow and led him to the kitchen, where she grabbed a crostino with smoked salmon and capers, then walked him to the front door where she knelt to put her boots back on.
Follow me, she whispered forcefully, her mouth still full of crostino, breath smelling of fish. We gotta talk outside, just in case I spring a leak.
Mikey said, excuse me?
In case I cry, she said.
You don't cry, Mikey said.
Exactly.
Mikey put his own shoes back on and followed Alice outside. A bit of fresh snow had accumulated in the last hour. Already, at only 5 o'clock, the sun was gone. The sky was navy to the east and rose-colored to the west, with stars beginning to wink overhead. They stood on the porch. Alice sighed heavily and stared out over the snowy landscape. A blackbird strutted across the telephone line before them. She reached into her pocket, withdrew a little tab of Nicorette from a foil packet, and crunched into it. Mikey glanced at Alice's face, and he knew immediately.
Finn, he said.
Alice nodded.
Yesterday, she said, in a voice so thick with pain.
Mikey embraced her, his neck on hers. He felt her swallow hard many times in a row.
He said, do you want to talk?
Alice shook her head.
I want you to stand here with me for 5 minutes and not talk. Then I'll be ready to go have fun.
Mikey gazed at her. Alice tapped her left wrist with her right index finger.
5 minutes, she said, starting now. Don't talk. Just tell me when it's time and I'll be ready.
Issa's cousin was at the piano and playing North of the Sunset when they re-entered the house. Alice took a few calming breaths and blew her nose into a cocktail napkin she'd pulled from her pocket. Then she bobbed her head along with the whimsical tune as she removed her boots. She threw her hair out of her face in handfuls. As they made their way back toward the group, Alice whispered to Mikey,
I just had the best idea for the most messed up trick to get back at Jimmy.
Get back at Jimmy for what?
For that evil story he told us at his lake house. Scared the crap out of me. I think about it every time I see a couple getting their picture taken. Every time I hear a train.
What do you have in mind?
I'm not telling you because you'll forbid it.
Mikey filled a plate for himself with barbecued chicken and curried cauliflower, and he refilled his glass with Prosecco. He watched Alice out of the corner of his eye as she engaged in conversation with Lynn's aunt. The two of them parted, and Alice made her way across the room where, Mikey could see, she had a good view of Jimmy. Mikey made eye contact with Alice. Her expression was giddy with anticipation. She tipped her chin toward Jimmy, indicating that Mikey should listen in. Mikey posted himself up against the wall several feet away from Jimmy and Odvin, and he sipped his Prosecco. Lynn's aunt casually approached Jimmy and Odvin. She introduced herself to the two of them, and Jimmy introduced himself as a close childhood friend of Lynn's.
Another one, Lynn's aunt said.
Jimmy nodded.
Lynn's aunt said, so now I've met you and Alice and Sam and Mikey and the blonde.
Jimmy cocked his head at her perplexedly. Mikey felt a pumping, mischievous laugh in his chest, a perverse thrill as he realized what Alice was up to. Lynn's aunt looked at Jimmy, her face owlish and quizzical. She said,
the thin blonde? Another childhood friend?
introduced herself to me outside before the ceremony, then she just sort of disappeared.
Jimmy's face displayed a stunned horror for only a split second, before his eyes rolled dramatically and his posture relaxed.
"Alice," he growled, looking for her in the room. He turned briefly to Lynn's aunt. "She's good," he said, "and you're good. Almost had me."
Alice bounded over from the far side of the room and practically tackled Jimmy.
"Almost had you," she said.
Jimmy said, "You and your twisted, nihilistic little games." They laughed and laughed as Mikey explained the trick to Arvin, whose eyes glimmered with admiration as he clucked his tongue at Alice and said, "This woman seems very hip."
They ate and drank and toasted and danced and laughed for hours, the whole room loose and dizzy with happiness. Eventually, it was completely dark outside. The food was gone, and the bride and groom were weary. They all said their farewells to Lynn and Issa and one another, and made plans for a reunion in June or July. Sam suggested that everyone come to Georgia, but said they had only one spare bedroom at their home. Jimmy said he'd look into a week-long rental in their area that would accommodate all of them. Outside, there were several inches of fresh snow packed hard on the streets which had not been plowed. The sky was starry and clear.
Chapter 29 Mikey followed Alice to the Budget Inn 10 minutes away, where they both checked into their rooms. Alice gave Mikey the second key to her room and invited him to come over as soon as he was settled in. She said she was going to order a pizza and asked if Mikey had a preference on toppings. Alice was sitting upright in the queen bed when Mikey entered her room a bit later. A bottle of whiskey was on the bedside table, and she was sipping out of a little plastic cup. The pizza had arrived and was on the middle of the bed. Alice plucked a steaming pepperoni off it. The TV was on, an old episode of Law and Order playing at low volume. Alice patted the pillow next to her. Mikey poured himself a whiskey, using the plastic cup sitting next to the single-serve coffee machine, and took a seat next to her on the bed. The springs of the cheap bed bounced and crunched beneath him. Alice said, "I beg of you, please do not pass gas in my bed." She reached for a piece of pizza and pulled it onto a paper plate, a string of hot cheese trailing behind it. She twisted this around her finger until it broke. It was quiet for a few minutes as they ate pizza and watched TV. Eventually, Alice said, "Just so you know, I'm not going to make you talk about what you don't want to talk about. Unless you want to talk about it." Mikey helped himself to a second slice of pizza.
"You mean the phone call? A baby?"
Alice nodded. She looked utterly miserable.
"Please just don't," she said. "I know what you're going to say. Don't speak. Shut up. Leave me alone."
She tossed her black hair over her shoulders. Mikey looked at her.
"Sorry," she said. "I'm being mean because I'm feeling vulnerable, and I know what you're going to say."
"Do you?"
She pointed at the actor on screen. "I read that that guy kicks his dog in real life."
"Really?" Mikey said.
"No, I'm just trying to change the subject."
Mikey adjusted his glasses over the bridge of his nose.
"I talked to my eye doctor," he said.
Alice turned to face him.
Mikey said, "It's over a 90% chance it's hereditary. Can't be sure without any information on my biological father, but there's a very high likelihood that my children would suffer early onset macular degeneration, go blind at a young age."
Alice nodded.
"I understand," she said. "I don't want to pass this on to someone."
Mikey sipped his whiskey.
"You know, I'd never given much thought to having kids before you brought it up. When the doc told me this, it upset me more than I thought it would."
"The idea of not having kids?" Alice said. Mikey shook his head.
"Not that." He chewed on a piece of ice and swallowed. "The idea of not being able to give you what you want."
Alice said, "Oh." She tapped a crust of pizza over her knee. Mikey was quiet for a bit.
Then he said, "Would you consider doing it any other way?"
Alice took a bite of pizza and chewed slowly. She looked directly at Mikey, pushing black hair from her eyes.
"I won't do this if it's not with you. And I'm not saying that to make you feel bad."
She paused, gulped down the last of her whiskey, poured herself another, and handed the bottle to Mikey.
"I know I'm pushy, but I couldn't push you into something this big. I wouldn't. I won't. I respect your decision. It's over and it's okay."
Alice looked back toward the TV. Mikey shifted on the bed.
"Maybe I'd reconsider if..."
Alice cut him off with a hand in the air.
"Mikey, it's over. And it's okay."
Mikey caught her hand out of the air, laced his fingers through hers, and held it tightly. A few seconds later, she pulled away and said,
"Your hand is hot and wet, and I don't like it."
It was quiet for a long while. Eventually, Alice closed the empty pizza box and tossed it toward the foot of the bed. She said, "The saint and I divorced because he tried to force me to have a kid with him. So I'm not about to do that to you."
Mikey turned to face her.
"He wanted kids and you didn't?" he said. "Was that it?"
"Not exactly. I just wasn't sure one way or the other. Hadn't even given it much thought. Then, all of a sudden, I was pregnant. I missed my period, bought a test, and took it on my own. Got the old double line."
"Huh?"
"Means it's positive."
"Did you tell him right away?"
Alice sighed. "No, I wanted to think things through privately first. I called up the nearest women's health center to talk through my options. I was only 6 weeks along. I didn't make an appointment, but I got all the info and decided to sit on it for a bit."
"So what happened?"
"That same night, Jason saw the number for the women's health center in my phone."
"Who?" It occurred to Mikey that he had never even known the saint's real name.
Oh. "Apparently, he snooped on my phone all the time," Alice said. "Paranoid that I was cheating. I wasn't. I was careful with the pregnancy test itself to hide all the evidence, the receipt, all that, but I didn't think to erase the outgoing call in my phone. He saw the number on my phone that same night and figured out what was going on."
"He was upset?"
Alice nodded. "Furious that I would even consider not keeping it without consulting him first. I tried to explain that I hadn't made the decision yet. I'd only wanted to weigh my options on my own first, but that didn't matter. He threatened to put me on lockdown. Take my phone and the keys to my car and my credit cards so I couldn't do anything without him. He threatened to basically hold me hostage for 9 months. Threatened to sue me. Told me I was legally required to get his consent. I'd done my research. I knew I wasn't. He told me I was possessed. I was evil. He threatened to bomb the clinic. All sorts of craziness."
"Had he ever lost his head like that before? Did he scare you?"
Alice shook her head. "Not even close. Nothing like it. But Mikey, as soon as I learned that I was pregnant with his child, something inside of me just knew it wasn't right. Why else wouldn't my first phone call be to him? Something inside of me just knew it was not the life that I wanted."
Alice tucked her hair behind her ears. She uncrossed and recrossed her long legs over the bed and picked at a little stain on the comforter beneath her.
"So then what happened?" "I ran out of the house and never went back. Left all my clothes, my computer, my books, everything I owned. Ran out the door and drove to my brother's house a couple hours away. Never looked back."
"Jesus. And the pregnancy?"
"I miscarried a few days later. They say stress can bring it on."
"And how did you feel?"
"Mostly relieved."
"I'd imagine."
"He tried to get in touch with me through everyone we knew right after I left. My parents, brothers, mutual friends. He told everybody I had run away with his baby, and he begged them to stop me from ending the pregnancy. He even said he didn't even care if he never saw me again. We could separate, and he would happily raise that baby on his own. Can you believe that? My brother finally told him I'd miscarried, and then my brother helped me with the paperwork, got the divorce legalized without my ever having to sit in the same room with him. Years later, Jason looked me up on Facebook, said he'd come to peace with me, even though I had hurt him worse than anyone ever had and probably ever would. I sent him some curt little response. He still reaches out from time to time, and every time I hear from him, he reminds me that he's still praying for me. Alice snorted. Although he's never specified what exactly he's praying for me. Salvation or the seven plagues. I just hope whoever's listening to his prayers gets where I was coming from. Mikey said, "Why did you never want to tell me any of this? Were you worried what I would think?" Alice was quiet for a bit. "Do you remember back at the lake house last month when somebody brought up the worst thing you've ever done? Or the worst thing someone has ever done to you? I can't remember the context. I bet you, if someone asked the saint what the worst thing anyone has ever done to him was, his answer would be that I called to find out the price of ending a pregnancy before telling him I was pregnant. What I'm saying is that, in his mind, what I did to him will probably always be the worst."
"You're probably right."
"But for me," Alice went on, "questioning whether I wanted to keep it and then ultimately deciding to leave him was probably the best thing I've ever done."
"So?"
"That sucks," Alice said, throwing her hands into the air. "Shouldn't my answer to the question, what's the worst thing you've ever done, be the thing that hurt someone else the most?"
"No way," Mikey shook his head. "This is just the reality when you have reasons for doing something that could never be understood by someone else."
It wasn't until years after we separated that I could actually appreciate the loss from his perspective. I didn't share his feelings about the pregnancy, but I couldn't discount them entirely either. Frankly, I'm amazed by the depth of emotion he had toward that tiny little sack of cells. See, I don't think this was entirely about controlling me. That had never been part of his nature before. I think this was actually about the baby. He cared that deeply, wanted that badly to protect it, felt that was his duty. He, dare I say, already loved it? Is that possible? I don't actually know the answer to that.
Alice paused and sipped her whiskey.
Mikey said, "I don't either." "My point is that I can laugh at the saint. I can resent him, despise him even. But I can't quite find it in me to diminish his pain or find any humor in it. I don't want to be someone's worst thing. That hurts me."
"I'm surprised you're bothered by a thing like that.
Mikey, you know I like to consider myself a loose cannon, but ultimately harmless."
"Nobody's harmless," Mikey said. "Sorry."
Alice sniffed and rubbed each nostril. It was quiet for a few moments. Eventually, Alice said,
"Sally cutting herself off was one of the worst things that happened to all of us. Maybe the worst. But maybe it was the best thing for her. Like you said, we could never understand her reasons."
Alice reached for her cup of whiskey and finished it in a single swallow.
"Like you said," she remarked, "nobody is harmless."
Mikey said, "How do we live with that?"
"What's the alternative to living with something that hurts?" Alice said. "Jump off a bridge?"
She hesitated.
"I don't mean that as a joke. How does anybody live with anything? You just march on, I guess, even when your heart's not in it."
Alice was quiet for a little while. Then she lifted her own sleeve, rolled it back, and pointed at a large patch of inflamed red skin, running all up her forearm to the inside of her elbow, some small areas gleaming with pus, some spots of dried black blood.
"Poison oak," she said matter-of-factly, "from bushwhacking behind the marina. New owner's gonna put in a 2-car garage. It's driving me nuts, and if I scratch, it only gets worse. Disgusting. Are you disgusted?"
Mikey said, "I'm impressed."
"Impressed?"
Alice rolled her sleeve back down.
A scar is something to be impressed by, Mikey. A rash is just vulgar.
She patted her forearm, pulled a pillow onto Mikey's lap, and rested her head there. She turned up the volume of the TV as though she was done talking. An hour passed. Mikey watched a full episode of Law and Order as Alice rested. Benson was right about the perp again. When would those other cops ever learn? Benson's instincts were never wrong. Mikey gazed down at Alice's face, moving his head around to bring her fully into focus as best as he could. Broad, pale cheeks, small C-shaped indents at the corners of her mouth, lips parted, uncommonly peaceful, although even in sleep her eyebrows arched high, as if she were waiting for a punchline. Mikey felt deeply sad. He looked around the hotel room. A single rogue slat on the gray drawstring shutters, and beyond that, the black outdoors, dusted with stars that were low and shy. A bone-colored ashtray sitting on the bedstand, hilariously, next to a small laminated card that read "No Smoking." A sizable purple stain on the carpet. Cheap red wine. Had to be. A shabby little desk, no accompanying chair, with a thick blue Ethernet cord snaked across it. He looked back at Alice's face. Debussy's Arabesque number 1 for piano. Then he had to look away. Eventually, Alice stirred. She sat upright in the bed, rubbed her eyes, yawned, pushed black hair from her face, and squinted over at the digital clock on the cable box. It was nearly midnight. She said, "I suppose I ought to send you back to your room for the night. I don't sleep well with anyone else in the bed anyway, and you'd probably sweat up the sheets. But first I'm going to tell you about dying." Mikey gazed at her, and she stared straight ahead at the TV. Then she said, "You remember Jake, my dog when we were kids?" "Of course." "Good dog," Alice said. "I was in my freshman year of college. Jake was old as dirt by that time. Blind and deaf. Couldn't keep food down. He was skin and bones. My parents said that it was time they were going to put him down, and I begged them to wait until I was home for Christmas so I could say goodbye."
"Did they?"
Alice nodded. "They kept him around until I got home the week before Christmas. But that same night, after I'd seen Jake, middle of the night and while I was in bed, he crawled down to the basement. God knows how. His hip bones were probably practically dust at that point. He hadn't done stairs in ages. But he made his way down there and into the far corner, way back behind the water heater, far as he could get from the people in the house. Curled himself up and died. It took us forever to find him the next day.
They say that's how animals often do, right? They prefer to be alone."
Alice nodded. "It's a wild instinct. They've got it in their blood. See, chemicals given off by a dead body can be toxic to the ones left behind. Nature knows it's better for the pack if the dying one makes their way off quiet in the night. Anyhow, that was Jake. Now Finn."
"Finn was a bad dog," she said. "Growled at little kids, pooped and peed all over my house like it was his job. Tore up every piece of furniture in the place, destroyed every pair of shoes I owned, never did learn to sit or stay. He ate a bird. He barked incessantly. He was so stupid. You know I loved him, Mikey. That dog was the love of my life, but my God, he was a bad dog. And then all of a sudden, before I knew it, Finn was an old dog. Poor thing. His insides were just stalling out, inoperable. Last week, a couple nights in a row, Finn got up from his bed in my room in the middle of the night where he always slept and made his way out of my bedroom and over to the front door, like he had some place to go. I knew what was happening, what he was trying to do. I knew it was time. But I didn't want him to be alone in his final moments like Jake.
even if that's what nature was telling him to do.
Alice swallowed and closed her eyes before continuing.
Yesterday, before the vet put the needle in Finn, I held him there, hugged him and rocked him over the table. I hadn't planned out what I would say or do or how it would go because I just couldn't bear to think of it before the time came, but when the time came, I held his tired gray face in my hands and I said, "You are the perfect dog. You are perfect. You can rest now. You were always the perfect dog."
Alice stopped speaking, and Mikey didn't know if this was the whole story, but she seemed to be done telling it. She cried a little bit, and he held her.
Chapter 30. Several weeks later, Mikey was picking up gloves, a trowel, and a 5-gallon bucket from the Bed Bath & Beyond in Tonawanda. Alice, who now lived in the area, was planning to take him worm-picking as soon as the ground thawed. She had instructed him on what materials to bring for himself. She had told him to get a mask if he thought the smell of earthworms would bother him. She knew he had a weak stomach. But Mikey said he thought he'd manage. It was gray outside, very cold and very windy. Early March. Mikey wasn't technically supposed to be driving anymore, with the recent changes to his eyesight, but he made exceptions for himself and avoided highways. The wind swirled around Mikey and hollered in his ears. While he loaded these materials into the back seat of his car, his eye fell on the vehicle parked next to his. An old teal Chevy Chevette with rusted-out wheel wells, one of its back windows punched out and replaced with tarp that was sloppily duct-taped to the outside of the door. Mikey gazed at the shopping cart parked at the back end of the Chevette. The cart was positively stuffed full and overflowing with fake flowers. Massive plastic tiger lilies, silk peach roses, polyester peonies, way too blue baby roses on green strings, lightweight plastic pots with fake soil units. Mikey stared at the flowers, then at the woman who was now unloading them into the trunk of the Chevette. The woman wore a puffy black coat over gray sweatpants and little pink sneakers. Her yellowy-gray hair was very thin, parted in the center and pulled into a low ponytail. Her skin looked both incredibly shiny and incredibly dull, and she had a little burr of a face. Everything about her had a gray hue, including her pale, creamy eyes. Her posture was bent and humpbacked, and it took Mikey only a moment to recognize the woman as Corinne. Mikey stared at Corinne, unwilling to allow the word mother to enter his mind as she continued to unload the fake flowers into her trunk, moving painstakingly but with purpose. Corinne was focused on the task at hand, untangling a length of rosebuds on a string before gently placing them in the trunk. Mikey tried to picture Corinne unloading all these plastic plants into the home she had shared with Sally on Ingram, just several houses up from his father's. That sad little gray house. Its siding faded and splintering off, roof tiles practically shredded, the lawn an absolute disaster of overgrown ryegrass and bullthistle. Mikey tried to picture Corinne carrying these fake flowers into that home, using them to replace the wilted flowers she would have received around the time of Sally's death. He wondered if Corinne had already disposed of those dead flowers and the vases full of foul and cloudy water. He wondered if, in this collection of plastic flowers, Corinne had gotten an exact replica for every single one she had received at the time of Sally's death, and would arrange them the exact same way in her home. He wondered if she intended to spend the rest of her life in a static and unchanging version of grief, these flowers collecting dust but never dying, never even fading. Mikey didn't have a clue what Sally and Corinne's life together had been. How much there might have been between them, love or other stuff. He had not a clue how they lived. His thoughts flickered briefly to his own biological father. Not a clue about this man, either. Not a clue how his own life might have been different
had Sally's biological father stuck around to be a father to her, or if Mikey's biological father had stuck around to be a father to him. Not a clue how things would have been different if he hadn't wandered out of Corinne's house and up the street that sunny afternoon, or if he had ended up on a different front lawn. There were things that Mikey's heart simply didn't have the energy to even try to imagine. Corinne had finally loaded all of her plastic flowers into the trunk and was struggling to reach the door to close it, the strain of stretching out her bent back causing her to grimace. Mikey said, "You need a hand?" Corinne stepped back, giving Mikey room to help her with the door. She did not seem to recognize him. Mikey gripped the door and slammed it into place. He patted the bumper of the Chevette. Before getting into her car, Corinne gazed briefly at Mikey with a face that was utterly stricken. So much pain, Mikey had to look away. Mikey watched, a frosty wind biting at his face, as the teal Chevette pulled out of the parking lot. He wondered if Corinne had been over the Skyway since, or if, like him, she still took the long way around. He watched as her car, far away now, inched slowly north from one gray land to another. Chapter 31. It was nearly a month later before the ground had fully thawed. Alice picked Mikey up at 2 o'clock in the morning on the first Sunday of April. She told him she'd need his help, so he'd better not sleep through his alarm. He wore an old Carhartt work jacket belonging to his father, jeans, boots, and gloves. She drove them 30 miles east, to the woodlands near Corfu. Alice wore a headlamp and carried a shovel. Mikey had a 5-gallon bucket hanging from his elbow, a trowel, and a knit cap in the bucket. The world crunched beneath their feet. Mikey's vision was deteriorating very quickly now, with a noticeable change almost every day. It was especially poor in the dark, so Alice held his hand as they made their way up a narrow trail, and she watched for obstacles in his path. The only sounds, aside from their own footsteps, were of faraway night birds and leaves muttering against one another when the wind stirred. At one point, Mikey said, "You sure this is safe for us to be out here? Middle of nowhere, middle of the night like this? You sure we're not gonna stumble onto some wacko's private property?" Alice said, "Safe? Have you seen the movie Deliverance?" Alice snorted. "Mikey, you really need to get with the times." Alice used a GPS to pinpoint the exact location that had been recommended to her by a fellow local fisherman who she had met while scouting out locations for her marina. Mikey had accompanied Alice on a number of these trips, up and down the outer harbor, by the Erie Basin, near the Times Beach Nature Preserve. Although he couldn't see well enough to offer much of an opinion on the location and structure of the buildings she was considering, Alice liked to get his take on the sentiment of the place. The first time she had asked Mikey what he made of the sentiment of a certain location, he'd misheard the question. He sniffed the air and answered, "Dead fish, cigarettes, boat gas, they all smell the same." "Not the scent, you dummy," Alice said, "the sentiment." "What do you mean? How does it feel to you?" "The air? Damp, cool, fresh, fishy." "What does your heart feel?" "My heart? Aside from the obvious, I rarely know what my heart feels." "What's the obvious?" "Just that it's still working." Once the GPS indicated that they had reached the proper spot, Alice told Mikey to sit tight while she dug in with the shovel. The ground gave easily beneath the blade of the shovel and made gentle whoomp noises as she lifted out shovelfuls of wet soil until she hit limestone and a loud clash sounded. She continued to dig around it, grunting with the effort. Then she paused to assess. Mikey could hear her fingers combing through soil. The night air smelled of evergreen and overturned earth and iron. "They weren't lying," Alice said. "Lots of worms?"
"Yeah."
Mikey said, "What do you want me to do?"
"Hold the bucket for me," Alice said.
Mikey stood next to her and held the bucket while Alice rooted around on her hands and knees, and soon she started depositing worms into the bucket with little plops.
"Good, good, good," Alice murmured. "Fatties."
The air was very cold on Mikey's face. Far away, an eastern screech owl bawled into the night. Mikey's sense of smell had continued to intensify with the loss of his sight, and he wished now that he had taken Alice's advice and brought a mask. The ripe, raw scent of earthworms being pulled from the ground was making him a bit sick to his stomach. He could feel movement in the bucket. He nosed under the collar of his shirt, breathing in the scent of laundry detergent. Some small animal rustled in a nearby bush, then bounded swiftly away. He could hear it moving for a long time. The screech owl sounded again, and Mikey's thoughts turned to a conversation he'd had with Sally when they were children. She had told him about the strange and unpredictable migration of various solitary animals she had learned about in her science class, including the snowy owl. Mikey didn't know what migrate meant, so Sally explained.
"It's a long journey that an animal takes," Mikey said. "To find food?"
"Sometimes," Sally said.
"But sometimes they go for reasons the scientists don't understand. Sometimes, well, it's like sometimes nature just puts something in their heart that makes them need to go, and so they go."
Eventually, the bucket Mikey held began to grow heavy. He said, "Why am I holding this thing anyway?"
"Huh?"
Alice stopped her work, and he could tell vaguely from the flash of her headlamp that she had turned to face him.
"Why am I holding this bucket?"
Mikey set it down on the ground next to his legs.
"There's nothing for me to do," he said. "I can't drive, can't dig, can't follow a GPS, can't see the worms to pick 'em, and there's no reason for me to be holding this bucket. Why am I here? Why did you make me come? I'm not helping you."
They had walked a good 20 minutes from where Alice had parked in order to reach this particular spot, and Mikey could tell from the sounds and from the texture of the air here that it was very thickly wooded, spongy and pungent. He could hear no evidence of human civilization, no cars, no voices, no white hum of electricity. The air felt old and cold and alive and haunted.
"I'm not helping you," he said again.
"Yes, you are," Alice said.
It was quiet for a while. Then Alice returned to her work, humming as she tossed more worms into the bucket, which now rested on the ground. Plop, plop, plop. Far away, the screech owl sounded, a scream in the darkness. Mikey wondered if the thing was waiting for an answer, or just howling to howl. Mikey said, "You are my best friend." Chapter 32. John Callahan was admitted to St. Mary's Hospital on a Tuesday afternoon in May, after experiencing pain in his chest. He was released within hours when his EKG returned completely normal, but the doctor advised that he retire or find other work that involved less heavy lifting. John did not want to stop working altogether, so Mikey offered to help him look for job postings on Craigslist. By the time he accepted Mikey's help, John had already been hard at work on his own resume, using a sloppy and outdated template that, inexplicably, he had paid some website $2.99 to download. The two of them sat together at Mikey's kitchen table one evening, and Mikey listened as his father read aloud the entire contents of his resume. The date that he graduated high school, followed by a single paragraph describing his duties at the meat plant. Mikey helped his father respond to ads online for cashier positions at the Home Depot, Tops, and Walmart. His father seemed quickly exhausted by this, so they decided to call it quits and drink a beer together. It was a mild spring evening, and they took plastic chairs out onto the porch. Up the street, a push mower buzzed back and forth across a small lawn. Children chafed the sidewalk with skateboards and rollerblades, and the air smelled as green as could be. Mikey's father said,
Hell of a sunset.
He glanced over at Mikey.
You seen any of that?
Mikey squinted out across his lawn, over the darkness of the tree line to the west.
Little bit of pink, he said. Little bit of blue.
That's about all I can make out. Colors are all thin and faded to me now, like the whole world was washed in too hot.
His father was quiet for a bit. Then he said,
There's pink, and there's also purple, and blue, and yellow, a strip of gold, some more pink, almost like tiger stripes against purple, and also orange.
Mikey was struck by the peculiar idea that he and his father were trying to become friends.
His father said, You had a thing about skies, didn't you? You remember that solar eclipse when you were a kid?
Mikey nodded. Happened when I was in school.
You were all charged up about it, his father said. I'd never seen you so excited for something. They must have really got you worked up about it in your science classes. You made me promise that morning that I'd go out on my lunch break so I'd see it too.
Mikey said, Did you?
No, his father said. I forgot all about it. Worked straight through the afternoon.
They sat in silence for a while longer. As Mikey sipped his beer, he was suddenly rewarded with a clear and distinct memory of the solar eclipse. He let the memory sail into him, and he grabbed at every detail. The students had spent weeks preparing for the eclipse with their science teachers. They learned how, in ancient cultures, a solar eclipse was attributed to the supernatural and thought to be a bad omen. But these days, of course, they knew better. They learned that the diameter of the sun was approximately 400 times that of the moon. They learned the definition of corona, umbra, and annulus. They learned about the dangers of exposure to sun even at this great distance. The teachers explained that they must protect their eyeballs while viewing the eclipse so that they wouldn't burn their retinas off. Anyone who didn't use their pinhole viewing box could go blind, the teachers said. So each student had been given their own cardboard box, uniformly sized and without a bottom seam. Each box had the name of the student sharpied big and black along the side. On the afternoon of the solar eclipse, the children were arranged outside by grade, which meant Mikey was separated from his friends, who were all one grade above him. The principal was giving instructions over a megaphone. It was late fall, and a dry wind spun through the schoolyard. Now they were told to put their box over their head. Mikey shivered inside his box. He had reminded his father about the eclipse that morning, and his father said he would try to take his lunch break at that time so he could be watching it too, at the same time. A strange, holy silence settled over the schoolyard. Mikey couldn't help himself. He lifted his box back up over his head and set it at his feet. He did this carefully and silently, making sure he did not brush against the students on either side of him. He then gazed across the schoolyard. A massive labyrinth of brown boxes held at different heights, but identical upward-tilted angles. All those brown boxes with all those names written across them. All those little heads inside watching and waiting for the beautiful thing to happen. There were his five friends, all next to one another, several rows away. He knew them by their shoes and pant legs and postures, without even reading the names on their boxes. Alice was either dancing or stamping her feet impatiently. Everyone else was still. Sally's words from several weeks earlier returned to Mikey's mind. It might be the most beautiful thing we'll ever see in our whole lives, she had said of the eclipse. It was a clear, cold November sky above the schoolyard, with just a few thin, smeary clouds, like hurried white brushstrokes, and Mikey stared right up into the brilliant amber sun as the moon moved into place. It was not like Mikey to break the rules. But now that the beautiful thing was happening, he could hardly bear not to feel it on his whole face. What a universe! There was so much to see, so much to feel. And yet, if there was one thing Mikey knew of feelings, there was always that other feeling, crouched and waiting nearby in the shadows. Even at a moment like this, even when he was on the brink of the most beautiful thing he would ever see in his life, it was the low tide. The sacred, empty void after the birds had taken flight. The tangled thing that tugged on Mikey, kept him sewn up inside himself, made happiness hard. Mikey didn't yet have words for this feeling, but already at this young age, he understood that it would never leave him entirely. Nature had put it in his heart, and there it would always remain, even when he thought he was in the clear, even when he thought he had left it behind. Mikey had asked his father about this feeling once, years earlier, when he was very small, and before he had learned that it was foolish to talk plainly about feelings. Mikey had said, "I have a bad, sad feeling in me sometimes." His father said, "Me too." And knowing that his father shared this had been such a great comfort to Mikey that over time he began to cherish that shadowy feeling, which proved to be as sure as the tides, as persistent and reliable as a dear friend, as real and as much a part of his universe as the sun. Chapter 33. Jimmy had rented a house on Lake Oconee, an hour from Sam and Justine's home, for the second week of June. Aside from Mikey and Alice, it would be the first that any of them had seen one another since Lynn's wedding, although they had stayed in close touch via email over the intervening months. Justine was now 12 weeks pregnant, and they were ecstatic. They planned to wait to find out the gender, but both suspected a boy. Sam's company was opening a second branch near Cleveland in the fall, and they planned to move back to the Midwest to be closer to both families. They would miss their church, Sam said, but weren't too crazy about the new pastor anyway. In September, Lynn and Issa would depart for Addis Ababa, where they would spend 1 year teaching music at the grade school Issa had attended as a boy. When they returned to the States, they planned to move to Buffalo in order to be closer to Lynn's mother. Issa planned to record his first album. Lynn had spoken to the current head of the AA chapter in Buffalo and conveyed her interest in a position with them upon her return. Audvin had moved to L.A. in April and met Jimmy's parents on their most recent visit out west. Jimmy said that his father went through an entire fifth of Sambuca in 2 days and didn't say a whole lot, but his mother absolutely adored Audvin. She couldn't stop touching his red beard. The two of them could do a bang-up impression of each other's accents. She taught Audvin the tarantella dance, which originated in Puglia, and he taught her his grandmother's recipe for apples Vibeck tort and marzipan nougat. Jimmy said that he and Audvin planned to spend summers at the lake house in Buffalo in the future. Audvin simply couldn't stand the heat of an L.A. summer. Jimmy said that they were in love. Alice now lived 10 miles from Mikey in Allentown and had purchased storefront property for her marina just off the northern shore of the Times Beach Nature Preserve. It was still several months away from opening, but she was slowly getting the place set up. She visited Mikey several times a week and called him every day, often more than once a day, and often with no apparent agenda. She would put him on speakerphone while folding her laundry or cooking a meal, or call him just to sing along to whatever song was playing on her radio while she drove. Shortly after moving, Alice had learned that Buffalo Philharmonic rehearsals on Tuesdays and Fridays were open to the public, so on these days, she would drop Mikey off at the auditorium and leave him there to listen to the entire rehearsal while she ran errands downtown. Mikey couldn't believe that in all his years in Buffalo, he had never known about these rehearsals. He had never once attended a Philharmonic concert, couldn't justify the cost to go alone, and it had never even occurred to him that there might be another way. Alice had no interest in sitting there with Mikey for a full 2-hour rehearsal, but she also never complained about taking him, and she would always ask all about it on the way home. She loved to hear about when one of the musicians had been singled out for playing out of tune or missing a cue. Back in May, Mikey had fallen in his own home, and he had to call Alice to take him to the doctor, where a cast was put on his broken wrist. Mikey was so disgusted with himself, humiliated. Alice had stayed at the hospital with him the whole time and listed herself as his emergency contact when the receptionist asked. Several days later, when Mikey was at her house, Alice had tried to outright deny the construction taking place on her front porch until he pressed her on it, and she confessed that she was having the stairs converted to a ramp. "I'm blind, not helpless," Mikey said. "I was just being clumsy."
"I know," Alice said, "but I don't want you to fall and break your neck at my house, then sue me."
Mikey laughed. It was quiet for a bit. "Don't lie to me," Mikey said. "I'm serious. Not about the ramp out front or anything else. It's not fair, because I just have to take your word since I can't see things for myself anymore." Alice gently took his hand and patted it. Then she forcibly dipped his fingers into a dish of something sticky and too warm. Mikey pulled his hand back into his chest and shook out his fingers. "What the hell was that?" Alice was laughing.
"I'm making marmalade," she said. "Lick your fingers if you don't trust me."
"I sure don't," Mikey said. He sniffed, then licked his fingers. Alice said,
"But in the spirit of full disclosure, there is something I need to tell you."
"Oh?"
"The other night, when I took you home from the hospital, you dozed off in the car, and I took the Skyway."
Mikey was quiet for a bit.
Alice said, "I'm sick of taking Niagara Street. It adds 15 minutes to the drive every time I want to take you anywhere. And anyway, Mikey, it's just time you got over it. Not Sally. I mean, I don't know if a person ever gets over something like that. But it's time you got over your fear of that place. Because now you've been there. You were right at that edge, and you never even knew it. We just passed right on by."
Chapter 34. Alice and Mikey had purchased seats next to each other on the flight to Atlanta, where Jimmy, Odvin, Lynn, and Issa would meet up with them at the airport, and the six of them would rent a car and drive together to Lake Oconee. Alice had promised to be at Mikey's home at 6 o'clock in the morning to pick him up and drive him to Buffalo Niagara Airport. It was now a quarter after, and Mikey was nervous about missing the flight. Friday was weaving between Mikey's legs and his suitcase, and Mikey knelt to touch Friday's warm face. Mikey's father had offered to stop over several times throughout the week to feed Friday and clean out his litter box. In recent months, Mikey's father had started coming to Mikey's home on Sundays instead of Mikey going to his, since it was no longer safe for Mikey to drive. And his father now had plenty of time on his hands. He was working 20 hours a week at the AutoZone. John had also discovered that if he took a Claritin an hour before coming to Mikey's home, his allergies weren't so bad at all. Mikey reached for his cell phone and dialed Alice. She answered after a single ring.
"Jiminy Christmas, you antsy pants," she said. "I'll be there in 5 minutes. I stopped to get McDonald's breakfast. You're welcome."
The two of them got breakfast from McDonald's together at least once a week. Alice always ordered 3 hash browns, a Coke, and a steak bagel for herself. The first time she had gotten this, Mikey watched as she ate the steak bagel.
"That actually steak?" he had said. "Or just a burger on a bagel?"
Alice had scowled at him.
"It's steak, or they wouldn't say so." "I got your usual biscuit and coffee, light and sweet like you like."
"You're welcome," Alice said again.
"Anyhow, are you going to need my help with your luggage?"
"No, I only have one suitcase."
"I'm just worried about missing the flight," Mikey said. "I've heard early morning security lines a beast, especially on the weekend."
"We can use your special blind person go to the front of the line free card if we need to."
"You know I hate doing that."
Alice said, "Chill." She hung up the phone. In the past month, Alice had helped order and install voice software for Mikey's home, extra railings, separate drawers for sharp kitchen items versus dull ones. She created an organization system for the refrigerator and his dresser, socks knotted together as pairs and arranged by color. She set up an alarm system that would contact her directly immediately on her cell phone if Mikey's carbon monoxide detector went off.